Joining us to give us some insight, not only to this year's draft, but how the whole draft process works, because he's a former NFL executive, hosting now on SiriusXM's NFL Network, moving the chains, writes for RealFootballNetwork.com. My bud Pat Kerwin joins us here on CBS Sports Radio. Are you ready for some NFL draft, Mr. Kerwin?
I am ready for it to be over, Jody, because I've been working on this thing for 4 months. And here's the way I do it. I do 7 players a day. I got all the college tapes. So if I miss a day, Jody, the next day I have to do 14.
14.
So I'm just about done now. I'm just cross-checking a bunch of guys today, and I think I'm going to put the films away and go with what I got. To do 256 players when you sit next to Gil Brandt, who will remember every player and every restaurant they ever ate in and what their mom majored in college, you got to do about 300 guys and be ready, because Gil will be ready.
Exactly. And I referenced Mr. Brandt yesterday, and I've done the show with you and had a chance to work with Gil, and there isn't a guy that I respect more in the National Football League. But he really went down the road of comparing Daniel Jones and Peyton Manning? What is that about?
Well, you know, it's funny. Now, Gil and I have had many conversations about Jones. So what went on? The guy goes to Duke, and he's coached by Cutcliffe, who coached the Manning brothers. And between Cutcliffe and how he molded the Mannings, and he's taken on many of the same properties with this kid. And when I've talked to Cutcliffe, he likes to compare Daniel more to Eli and his throwing motion and a lot of other mechanical things. But when you watch him on tape, you know, Peyton had a very unique way of even lining up in shotgun. He always had square feet. A lot of guys love tilted feet. He always has two hands with fingers spread. So when you watch Jones, you see the same thing. And I know that the Mannings hang around Duke quite a bit in the off seasons, and I'm sure they've had an influence on Daniel and themselves along with Cutcliffe. So I get where he's going. And, you know, there was a debate maybe 2-3 weeks ago. I think Daniel Jones, his agent, they were saying, we're not going to come to the draft. Gil had invited them. And I think their logic was, we're probably going to go in the second round. And Gil kept trying to tell him, and we talked about it, there are a number of teams that like Daniel Jones. So he's changed his mind. He's coming in the first round. And I had him at the Senior Bowl for a week, Jody, and I really like this guy. Now, if you watch him, he's got two things that really impressed me because they were awful. Number one, his line couldn't block. In the Virginia Tech game, he was getting hit literally on every pass play and completing passes with guys hitting him right in the mouth. And he also has the most dropped passes of any quarterback that's in this draft by his receiver. So he's overcome all of that to be who he is, and with a real good chance of going in the first round.
So you think he merits a first-round selection?
Yep.
Okay. We shall see. You're a bigger fan. You and Gil Brandt are both bigger fans than I am, but we shall see. At my age, I guess I should have gone and hung out with the Mannings, because I would have liked to have become an NFL quarterback too. Just being around Peyton and holding your hands the same way as he does, to me, don't think ever would have made me Peyton Manning, but we'll see if that works itself out.
I'll tell you the one thing that people don't talk about enough with him, and then we'll get on to whatever else you want, is the guy can really run. Unlike the Mannings, who can't run, this guy can really take off and has won and done some things in games with his legs that doesn't look anything like the Mannings. He can actually run to the end zone from 30 yards away and score.
I'll give him that much. He's certainly a better athlete than either of the two Mannings, but we'll see if he ever has anywhere near the success of either of the two Mannings. Pat Kerwin, our guest here on CBS Sports Radio. All right, speaking of quarterbacks, speaking of first round, Pete Prisco, our very own CBS, is today said he's hearing the Cardinals are not going to take Mr. Murray with the first overall pick, which from the combine on, that's all that we've heard, and it's become so widespread, it had almost gotten to the level of stone-cold fact that was going to happen, and now we're getting a report just a couple days away that it probably isn't going to happen. What are you hearing? Have the Cardinals gone too far down that road? Are they going to get cold feet and second-guess themselves? Is Kyler Murray going to drop in this draft?
Well, a couple things. I think they go back and forth. I don't think it's rock solid what they're going to do, take him or not take him. And I know Pete's trying to pursue that. Everyone's trying to pursue it. But you can ask the same guy 2 days in a row, and you might get a different answer, and they're not lying to you. I think a couple things on this front. If they're going to take Kyler Murray, they should move down in the draft. To your point you just made about, well, where will he go? Well, Arizona's the one who loves him the most, but I think you could get all the way down to 10, 11, and still get Murray. So why don't you parlay your desire for Murray into more things, more picks, more players? And with those three defensive kids up at the top of the draft, it'd be a good time to move out, I think. And, you know, what's the worst that could happen? You move down to 10, someone else surprises you and takes them, and you just say, well, we didn't want them anyway. And you've got all these extra picks. But I do think they should move down if they want them, and I think they're going to try to do it. Now, the biggest problem they're going to have is getting something in return for Rosen that's of value. And I don't think the one or two teams that have some interest are going to compete against themselves by throwing extra stuff at the Cardinals. And I don't think they can even, at this point, getting a second-round pick might be a miracle. And they might have to keep the kid around until the trading deadline or somewhere before the trade deadline and get someone who loses a player.
You mentioned the word value, and that was one of the things I wanted to get into today with you as a guy who's in the war room and part of the debates and different teams. I certainly understand do it differently, but there are probably some basic tenets that are across the board in the league. How tough is the balance between value and need? If a team has a roster, when they go into the draft, they can certainly analyze it and say, well, here are our strengths. Here's where we have not only top flight to starting talent, but depth. And here's where we have okay starter and no depth behind them or a gaping hole in our team. But come your spot on the board, if you don't have a player ranked at that position near where your selection's going to have, do you go reaching in the night? How difficult is that? How much is that a conversation, all seven rounds of an NFL draft, balancing need and value?
Yeah, it's always an intense conversation. And most guys aren't going to go 15 players away on a board to take a knee. But where the real issues are is the subjectivity of building the board. Look, everybody knows in those rooms when they're creating the board and stacking it where, in a sense, where they see that they attempted to quantify all the players, there is a subjectivity to it. You're sitting there, you're putting the board together, and you know you need a tight end. Well, it really makes it easy if you put a tight end up around where you're going. And next thing you know is the guy was at that point in the board, you know. So it's human nature, and I say this every time someone asks me about draft boards. They're like fingerprints. There are literally no two draft boards the same anywhere, and no two that have ever been duplicated by any two different groups because they see things different, and it is a beauty contest. So board manipulation, and I don't think it's a bad thing, but I do think you can't help but realize when you need something and you see a good player at it, you're going to probably put them up the board a little higher than you might have if you didn't need them. And that sets the board to be a legitimate selection. Hey, we took him. He was the highest guy on our board, and we needed him. But, oh, by the way, we needed a guy at that position. So you'd love to take free agency, which is before the draft, and fulfill your needs with veterans so then you could truly have an objective board and take the best player and not care if you already got a lot of players at the position. I mean, I always remember when the Giants took Jason Pierre-Paul, and the Giant fans went crazy because they had Strahan, they had OC, and people were going, what are you doing? Well, 2 years later, I didn't hear anyone complaining. JPP played pretty good until he had the accident with the fireworks. But those are the kind of times that you know someone's going by the board, when they take someone when they're already loaded out of position. So we don't see a lot of that anymore. We see a lot of need picks.
I liked your take on board manipulation starts well before we ever get to draft day. That makes a lot of sense to me. What didn't make sense to me was the story that broke during the week. John Gruden and Mike Mayock sent their whole scouting staff home the week before the draft and said, just go home. Just get out of here for now. And Mike and Grudog were there to left to look over the board and or if there's going to be any board manipulation, it's going to be those two doing it. Had you ever heard of anything like that before? And what was behind their thinking?
Oh, no, it's happened many times. Maybe not to the degree of notoriety that this one was, that everyone got exited out. But in a lot of teams, the guys who scout are information gatherers. They're not information decision makers. And a lot of places, after the scouts help set the board up and they battle over the grades and everyone's debating, somewhere as that board gets solidified, the GM, the college scouting director, and the head coach lock that board up, and they stop letting the scouts see how the board's going to shape up because they don't want those guys telling media members where the board is. In the case of the Raiders, look, there's not a Raider scout who thought he wasn't getting fired at the end of this draft. Now, they might keep one or two of them, but I doubt it. And this happens all the time. So you got a new GM in there and a coach who got rid of the person who hired all these scouts. So they're going to clean house and they're going to get a new scouting staff and they're going to be guys Mike knows and John knows. And so instead of having them see the board or be in that room, look, I was in a draft room with Dick Steinberg and it was wide open. The doors were open. Guys were having lunch, coming and going. Some guys were bringing family members, and Dick didn't care. And then I was with Parcells. And about 15 minutes before the first pick, Parcells said to everyone, make sure you go to the bathroom. And everyone did. And then he came in and he locked the door, and no one was getting out. No one was getting on a cell phone and saying, hey, we might take Jody with this next pick. So these guys that like security of it, and there's way more of them nowadays than ever. They do not want the scouts out telling. And I don't want to make it sound like scouts all do it, but enough do. And those weren't Mike's guys, so most of them are getting relieved of their duties as soon as the draft's over.
All right, you mentioned you're doing 7 players a day, and you've got them almost all done, going 200 deep, and you're almost ready to just live with what you determined and scouted and evaluated. I'm sure you're looking at other individuals and their process, if not talking to them on your show or talking them off the air. Has there been one guy that stood out one way or the other? You know what the general consensus is. Player's a top 15 pick. He's a first rounder, but not a top 15. He's a second round. He's a day 2 pick. He's a day 3 pick. You got a general consensus feel on all these guys. Who's the player who has stood out the most for you that you say, everybody else has got this guy higher than I do, or everybody else got this guy lower than I do, that you needed to double back and go, no, yeah, I feel this way. He's not as good as everybody's saying. He's way better than everybody's saying. Who's the guy who's confounded you?
Well, let me start at the top, because the first guy I started with, I did defense first because I thought it was going to be a predominantly defensive draft in the first round. So I started with the Alabama tackle. And then I used him as a point of reference. As soon as I got done with Quinnen Williams, I did every other defensive tackle in the draft, knowing where I felt the point of reference was. So do they stand up to him? Well, Christian Wilkins stands up to him. I prefer Quinnen, but Christian Wilkins at Clemson is not far off. And there are people that think of him as pick 15, pick 16. I don't know how they arrive at that. This is a big man who's a high-character guy, who's the best player on a four-man front that's all getting drafted. So I like him a lot more than others do. Ed Oliver was my next tackle, and there's a guy that has, in my mind, has to play in a 4-3 defense. So if you're a 4-3 team, your draft board's going to have him up in the top 5. If you're a 3-4 team, your draft board's going to have him somewhere around 10. Because he's a scheme fit. So that's the other part of these things. So I think the defensive tackle group is going to be strong. I think you'll see 4 of them maybe in the top 10. And then it'll dissipate for a while. And then by the time we get to the end of the first round, I think there'll be 6 of them. I'm thinking that's going to be 11 defensive linemen in the first round.
Wow.
So it's a great year for that stuff. The quarterbacks are always a big debate, and the Ohio State kid took a hit in the last couple of weeks, but I think it's media-driven. And this is the time, you know this better than anyone, Jody. We're all going to start telling lies if we're drafting. We're all going to say, hey, worried about his medical. Sweat's got a heart issue. Sweat has a heart issue? I went to the Senior Bowl. They passed him on a physical. He was terrific. He goes to the combine. They pass him on a physical. He runs the fastest 40 in the history of the combine for defensive ends. So the storylines are all out there in order for guys to fall right into the lap of someone who's probably thinking, I can't get to this guy unless I get a story going.
All right, Pat, one more. I got to get this one in, and I know you've stayed long, and I appreciate that. But, again, having gone through it and been part of it in different war rooms with different coaches and the like, and you know it leads up to the draft, and you're as well connected as anybody in the media aspect of the NFL, from your feel, are we going to have an active couple of days as far as trades go? Some years there's a handful of trades. There's never no trades, but some there are more than others, and some there are bigger ones in the first 10 picks and others that don't start till the second round. What is your feel right now for how active a trade market NFL draft 3-day show is going to be?
Yeah, I think it's going to be very active, and I'll give you a couple of reasons. Number one, there were already 9 trades that have been made last year or the year before that are into this draft, that players and positions have been moved around from things they wanted to do in 2017 or 16. So you've got that issue. You've got GMs, a lot of younger GMs that are just very aggressive and not afraid to trade, and they do it, and they have a relationship with each other. Then you have some of the other ones, like John Dorsey in Cleveland and Dave Gettleman have already done a few trades this offseason. Odell's gone and the big guard has gone in. And consequently, they got a relationship. So with Cleveland not having a pick in the first round, I could see them doing something again with the Giants who have picks. So here's how you look at it, as I look at it anyway. There are seven teams that have at least 10 draft picks. Most of them have 11 or 12. And then there are 7 teams that don't even have 7 picks. So the guys without picks, like Seattle, they only have 4 picks. They're going to want to move down, and they're trying to move down and try to get more picks. They want more young players. That's how you make your salary cap work. And the guys with a lot of picks are negotiating their way into positions to get the player of choice. You even look at the Patriots, and the Patriots are sitting there, and they got a dozen picks. They're going to see someone they want. They're going to go up and get them. And so I think there's going to be a number of trades. Put a number on the first and second round. I take the over-under at 6, and I take the over.
It'll make your draft day show that much easier and that much more fun. Enjoy it. Tell Mr. Brandt we send our regards, even though you say Jody Mack, not as big a Daniel Jones fan as you and I. We're going to have to wait and see on that one. But tell Gil I said hi. Pat, always great whenever you come on. Thanks so much for the insight today. We'll catch you the next couple of days covering the draft for SiriusXM.
Thanks for having me. Happy Easter.